have concerning the meditation practice or the instructions? Yes?
You mentioned last time that it was a good idea, as you pay attention to your breath, to find out which part of the breath is more interesting, which part is less.
Not so much interesting, but which is clearest to the awareness.
Which is clearest.
Yeah, there's a big difference.
Okay. What I find is that when I breathe in, and then I breathe out, and then I rest. And it's the part that I rest almost always where I lose the attention, because there's no sensation there to pay attention to.
Right.
But only by forcing myself to breathe unnaturally can I avoid that period of rest.
Let's see. The the usual instruction is that if there's a gap between the out-breath and the in-breath, or between the in-breath and the out-breath, is that rather than just kind of wait for something to happen or kind of be in the kind of empty space, find something concrete and tangible in the body to bring your attention to. It can be anything tangible in your body. But again, the usual instructions is bring your attention to what's called the contact points, places where your body is making contact, physical contact. So for example, the contact of the knees touching, or your feet against the floor, or your butt against the chair, or your lips touching, or your hands touching. And kind of in the same rhythm kind of how it is for you to breathe, you just kind of gently bring your attention to those contact areas in the body. And then when it's time to breathe in again, let your attention kind of flow back into the breath again. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You always want the breath engage in something concrete. Otherwise, it'll wander off. So, yes.
I have a question. This was posed to me by a friend of mine, because I personally don't have this problem, of course.
And none of the rest of us either. But we'll talk about it anyway.
When you start noticing all of the different ways that you're grasping and clinging, how do you go about changing?
Well, a little bit depends on what you learn about yourself. But if you take mindfulness, part of what mindfulness is to observe carefully what's actually going on, to learn about yourself. Then you can actually start studying that clinging, studying the nature of it, get to know it better. So a lot of what mindfulness practice would be is getting to know the particular movement of clinging much better. When does a person start clinging or grasping at things? Does it arise after the person feels a kind of dissatisfaction, or feels lonely, or feels depressed, or feels, what happens that kind of stimulates the clinging or the holding? Is it a sense of insecurity? Get to know it better, and as we get to know it better, we can make wiser decisions about what to do about it. So I would encourage your friend to study it more carefully. And the other thing is, and a part of all this, which is can be very useful, is to try to develop that non-reactive mind, which is often what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice, is to cultivate the ability to be non-reactive to what we notice about ourselves. The usual tendency is to, oh my God, is to judge ourselves. Oh my God, you know, here I am clinging, and clinging is bad, and I'm a bad person, or, you know, this is hopeless, I can't do it anymore. We kind of react in all kinds of ways. Or we give into it. Or clinging is good. You know, whatever I cling to is justified, and let's go for it. You know, and so we go out and go on shopping sprees and buy everything in sight, you know, because clinging is good. So to cultivate the ability to be non-reactive is a very, very powerful friend or aid to having a balanced life. So those two things, can your friend develop a non-reactive relationship to it so the clinging isn't fueled? And also to study it, can you, and in you study it more carefully, get to know it better. That goes a long way. Last week I gave the instructions of how to include thoughts, how to in the practice, how to make room for our thinking mind in the context of the meditation. Was that useful for some of you? Did you find that useful instructions? Were you able to put it into practice? What happened when you did? Yes, Michelle.
I can't meditate on my thoughts. I can focus on bodily sensations and my breath, but once I'm thinking, I'm off. So it kind of seems like a contradiction to me at this point. Uh-huh.
No. So I think, as I said, I think to someone last week, is perhaps what you need to do then is not meditate on, not include thoughts as part of what you're mindful of, but rather focus more on the basic mindfulness of the body and of the breath and of feelings until that becomes stronger. And once mindfulness becomes stronger, then the ability to be aware of something while it's going on becomes stronger, and then you can just be aware of your thoughts passing through, without latching on or getting involved. Mindfulness works partly under the premise or the idea that we can have an emotion and be aware we're having the emotion. We can have an itch and be aware we're having an itch. We can hear a sound and be aware that we're hearing the sound. And we can have a thought and we can be aware we're having the thought. So there's a little bit of space or gap or room that's made for the experience when it can be held in awareness. And it's possible to do that with thoughts. However, as is often the case for many people, we're so involved with getting lost in the world of thoughts that maybe for initially it's better to kind of just kind of ignore it or kind of keep coming back into the breath or keep coming back to the body until that becomes stronger. The other thing which I talked about last week is when thoughts are quite compelling, is rather than getting into the storyline of the thoughts, go into the bodily experience of what it's like to be consumed by thoughts, the felt sense of what it feels like to be thinking. And you usually find some kind of physical experience in the present moment associated with compulsive thinking. And that's a way of bringing mindfulness to thoughts that hopefully keeps you, helps you not get so involved in the storyline. Yes?
Two things. Going back to the prior issue, I agree with the lady back here. When I'm thinking in a margin, my mind is used up. And I know when I stop thinking, I know I've been thinking.
Uh-huh.
I can remember approximately when it started and what it was. But during, you know, so are you saying, that with time you can develop this kind of, this sort of margin around your thoughts where you can have an additional awareness of them?
For sure, absolutely. This is a very, very important function of mindfulness, is to develop that that ability to kind of spaciously be aware of what you're thinking. Because if we can't, if there's no awareness of something, there's no choice. And the freedom arises when there's more choice. And so you can choose, you know, in a sense, what track your thoughts are going to go on. Then you have much more freedom.
The thing is, in all the talk about thoughts, and you just said it again, compelling, there's an undercurrent, perhaps you don't mean it, perhaps you mean it, that thinking is unpleasant or compulsive or difficult, or especially in this community, I don't think I'm alone in making my living thinking.
Yes.
And doing it well and enjoying it, and you know, there's thinking that's compelling in the sense of you can revel in your thinking.
And right.
So it's a, you decide to set that aside and do something else like meditate.
I think that thoughts should be your friend. Your thinking mind should be your friend and not your enemy. Some meditators see it as being an enemy, being a problem, because they're constantly pulling you away. But what does it take for your thoughts, your thinking mind, to be your friend? And one of the ways it helps to do that is if you have some ability to be aware of what you're thinking while you're thinking, and have some modicum of choice involved in your thoughts. So, for example, I mean, many of us in this kind of world are quite in our heads all the time, and partly because it's our work, and partly it's because of the way our environment is set up, and the kind of way we talk to people, and you know, maybe we read all the time, or all the stuff that reinforces intellectual activity, and there's no ability to turn it off unless we do something dramatic. And so, for example, this wonderful movie, a little documentary I saw some years ago, of this man who his hobby was jumping off skyscrapers that were being constructed, under construction. He would sneak in at early in the morning, just as dawn, and when no one was about, and sneak into these buildings that were being built, and get to as high as he could in the building, and then he would leap off with this kind of little kind of parachute. And he would glide down the streets, and he'd land in the streets somewhere, and there'd be a getaway car, and they'd pack up the little parachute and, you know, rush off. So he was being interviewed, and he said, well, you know, it used to be that when I was younger, I used to race motorcycles. And I found it was a great way of relieving my stress, because I have all the stress at work and everything, and going and racing my motorcycle just kind of relieves all the stress. But now I have a family and two kids, and I have to work, and there's no time to kind of... Motorcycles take a lot of time. You have to go out and, you know, you have to take care of them and maintain them, and not only that, you have to kind of go off and be gone for a while and ride long enough to kind of have an impact on you. But I don't have time for that. So it's much more effective to just jump off buildings. By the time I get to the bottom, I'm very present, and all my stress is gone. So some people need something dramatic to happen to kind of, you know, break them out of their mold of thinking. And some people go running and different things people do, right, to kind of break it. Meditation is one way to kind of free ourselves from the compulsive thinking that many of us have that's kind of out of control. But meditation is more than just kind of a temporary breaking of it. Mindfulness is actually helping you to see more clearly. And then in the seeing clearly, develop the ability all along in your daily life also not to be caught up and lost in those things, to be able to step outside. When we start meditating, is it's quite humbling for many people, is to realize how our thinking mind is out of control, and it's quite compulsive, and we don't seem to have any kind of ability to have any choice in there. And slowly what we learn with meditation is that we learn to free ourselves and have some ability to be free of our thinking mind. And so that's what I argue, is it's fine to be thinking a lot. Thinking is our friend, and it's a lot of creative, wonderful things happen in our thoughts. But if we don't have the ability to turn it off, then we're a slave to our thoughts. And then if we couple that to an erotic activity, you know, to fear and anxiety and worry and, you know, all kinds of neurotic activity, then our tendency to kind of get lost in our thought world, all that creative potential gets used for worrying. You know, the human mind has a great great creative potential, and it's a bit of a pity to spend it all worrying. Is this making some sense to you, in responding to your question? Yes.
What I noticed during the week is that I could catch myself in my thoughts, and I was doing a lot of planning. And I know last week you mentioned that planning is could be a symptom of fear, and I actually don't consider myself, or at least haven't, you know, really considered myself a fear-based person, but I plan a lot. So it was interesting to look at that, and then also to notice that when I'm so into for example, I was walking while I was doing it, so I wasn't really seeing the beautiful path that I was on in this park. because I was planning from last week or next week, so it was interesting. And I was surprised that I could catch myself, you know, what, first of all, that I was thinking, and then secondly, well, what's the thought about, and kind of get to the root that maybe there's some air-based issues there.
It might be, it might not be, but it's often this.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. Okay, so let's start with a sitting. So take an alert posture that also allows you to relax around that alertness. A comfortable but alert posture. Gently close your eyes. And then you might take a moment to notice if there's any theme to your thoughts that seems particularly enticing or particularly compelling this afternoon or today or now. What happened at work today, or what's going to happen tomorrow or this evening, or and if you notice if there's a particular compelling theme to what you'll be thinking about, then you can be a little bit extra alert for when that theme creeps into your meditation, so you can catch it early, rather than not noticing it and kind of being swept up in it and carried away. So take a couple of deep breaths, feeling your body as you breathe in from the inside. Letting go, relaxing into yourself as you breathe out. And then letting your breath breathe itself. And if it's easy to do so, letting your breath be comfortable as you breathe. Noticing how the in-breath appears. Letting yourself let go with the out-breath as you breathe out. Maybe as if your breathing, the sensations of breathing in your body are like a wave washing across the shore of your body. The rhythmic coming and going of in-breath and out-breath. Allowing the connection with your breathing to create a non-reactive space that allows all things to take their own place. Whenever the mind wanders off in thought, then gently, without judgment, without reaction, begin becoming aware of the breathing again. Letting go of your thoughts and allowing yourself to sense and feel what it's like to breathe without straining or trying too hard. Simply allowing the in-breath, the out-breath to be there in awareness. mindfulness practice is the practice of developing your ability to be alert to what's happening in the present moment. Letting yourself be at ease in the present. There's no need to strive or to strain. But also, don't get caught up in the trap of trying too hard to relax. The middle way between striving and relaxation is alert recognition of what happens in the present. This particular breath. It can be very useful in meditation to notice if there's any resistance to what is happening in the present moment. And if there's resistance, then to make room in your mindfulness for the resistance also, to become aware of it, to recognize it. Always making room for whatever is actually happening. Bit by bit, developing continuity of mindfulness of the breathing. To stay with the breath over time. To stay with the full inhalation, the full exhalation. when the body becomes restless or uncomfortable, then that becomes the meditation, that becomes the mindfulness, making room and awareness for that experience. When feelings, emotions arise and become strong, then the emotions become the meditation, allowing them to be there as they are, giving them room to be as they are. Perhaps because of the level of stress or tension that a lot of us live with, there's sometimes a strong tendency for people to want their meditation practice to be a relaxation practice. And so there's a kind of either explicitly or kind of implicitly a kind of moving into relaxation or trying to relax as we sit. It's very important to recognize that relaxation and alert recognition are two different things. That relaxation and mindfulness are not the same thing. I think it's useful to think of mindfulness as kind of being like a muscle. And, you know, if you only exercise the muscle once, it's not going to get very strong. But what we do with mindfulness is we're constantly coming back to the ability to be alert and recognize oh, this breath, this in-breath, this out-breath, this sound, this sensation in my body, this feeling. And recognizing it, not just simply resting or relaxing. And it's kind of like turning on the light in a dark room. We turn on the light in a dark room and suddenly you see what's going on. We become alert to what's going on. But what happens with us is the light then turns itself off again. And then we turn it on again. And with time, the muscle gets stronger and stronger until the light becomes more continuous. But it requires that continuity of keep coming back, keep waking up, keep recognizing what's happening in the present moment until the recognition becomes more of a constant state, more of a continuous state. Does that make sense? But often people, what a lot of people want is they want to relax. But there's a kind of effort that needs to be made to kind of stay alert. And that feeling, people are so exhausted, they don't want to make the effort. They want to just kind of rest and relax. But in the long term, your meditation practice and the rest of your life will benefit a lot if you develop this muscle of alertness, this muscle of ability to be mindful. It is kind of like a muscle. And initially, sometimes it'll feel a little bit like, like a little bit too much effort, but with time it becomes effortless. So I've talked about how to bring mindfulness to the breath and how the breath is kind of the anchor or the central focus of certainly the meditation practice. And we cultivate the ability to stay alert in the present moment by coming back to the breath and coming back to the breath. And the breath is something very tangible and concrete in the present moment for most of us. And so it's a tremendous help in training the mind to be present as opposed to getting lost in all the thoughts that we might have. But in addition, we bring our attention to whatever is predominant in our experience. If the breath is not the predominant thing, we become aware of the sensations in the body when they're predominant, or the emotions when they're predominant, or the thoughts when they're predominant. So the idea being that we kind of wake up to what's actually happening in our life. We don't have to turn away and kind of have some kind of special experience, but rather we wake up to the kind of experience we're having of life in this particular moment. And it's a beautiful thing because, in a sense, our present moment's experience becomes the place where life becomes is given to us, becomes awake, becomes our gift. There's often a tendency to want some other experience as being the right place to be. And the real gift that Buddhist practice tries to give us is the gift of really being present for our experience as we have it right now. There isn't, in Buddhism, at least in theory, it isn't like some Buddhist is supposed to be telling you what your experience should be. What Buddhism is really giving you in a kind of silver platter is the experience you're already having. And whether you like it or not, that's your business. But to really give it to you fully, so you can savor it, get to know it really well. And in getting to know it really well and cultivating this ability to be non-reactive about what's given to you in the present moment, we discover a whole different intimate way of being in our life, in our life and lives of our friends and community. So I've talked about kind of the meditation practice, the basics of it. And the implication of all this is that there's nothing, no experience we can have which is outside of the scope of mindfulness practice. The basic idea is that all experiences that we can experience are things we can become mindful of. And the first time I realized this in my own practice, I felt a tremendous amount of joy because I realized that anything I can become mindful of, there's at least a theoretical possibility of developing freedom in the midst of that. Because there's mindfulness, there's a possibility of freedom. And if every experience I can possibly think of that I could have is one in which I can become mindful of, then the possibility exists that you can find your freedom in the midst of all of life's experiences. And there's no experience you can have, no matter how difficult or painful or depressing it might be, where you cannot cultivate and discover freedom in the middle of that experience. And when I realized that, I felt a tremendous amount of joy in that potential, that possibility. Now, one of the inevitable questions that people will ask once they start doing a meditation practice like this is they'll say, this is really great. I have a sense, a little bit, of what it's like to do it in meditation practice. But, you know, how do I do this in my rest of my life? How do I apply this to my work and my family and everything else? And it's one of the more rewarding questions someone can ask me, is how to apply mindfulness to all areas of my life outside of meditation. It's also one of the more difficult things to tell you how to do it, because it's your whole life, it's all the rest of your life. But part of the practice, the Buddhist practice, is not being given the answer to how to do it, but actually would rather for the students or the practitioners to have the interest. How do I do this? How do I bring attention, alertness? How do I bring investigation and inquiry into what is actually my lived experience right now in all aspects of my life, in my work and my family and everything? To have that interest, that's why I love that question so much when people ask me, well, how do I apply it to my rest of my life? Because when people ask that, that suggests that they're interested in that. And it's the interest in it which really will begin kind of moving you in that direction to kind of try to find out for yourself. So once you've so today I want to talk a little bit about how to develop the practice beyond just the basic instructions I've given so far. And there's two basic ways. There's kind of two forks you can take. You can take both forks if you'd like, or you can take one of them or the other, or take none if you want. One of the forks is the application of this practice in your daily life. How when you go into a stressful situation at work, and you're all kind of concerned and afraid of what your boss is going to think of you, and afraid of being, you know, you're failing in this particular task, or whatever difficult kind of challenging situation you're in, and you're wondering, how can I do it, you know, is rather than kind of figuring out what needs to be done, or rather than being reactive and lashing back at your coworker, is to discover, what is it like if I just bring awareness or attention and just notice, like, rather than being reactive and jumping to conclusion, let me just spend a few moments or minutes paying attention to what's going on here. That's an incredibly powerful thing to do. And because attention is often kind of not seen as being so productive, we don't often give ourselves that opportunity to stop for a minute and just pay attention here. What's going on here? Do I have to rush with my opinion? Do I have to rush with my reaction? Do I have to rush with my interpretation? Let's just take a minute here. Just breathe and kind of look around and see what's going on here. So this application of it to our daily life is very powerful. So that's one fork. The other fork is to cultivate this as a meditation practice to great depths. If we take the mind of mindfulness, the mind's ability to get concentrated, to be like a muscle, is to take the time in our life to develop this muscle to a really powerful degree so we can get tremendous stability of the mind, and with the stability of mind, kind of to really penetrate the present moment. And this involves having a very regular meditation practice at home, sitting every day. And in the context of sitting every day, allowing these mental factors of concentration, of mindfulness, of acceptance, of non-reactivity, to become stronger and stronger. You might never have thought of non-reactivity as being a capacity of mind you can strengthen, but it is. And it's a very useful one to strengthen. And it only gets strengthened by practice. We practice and we practice and we practice, and it gets stronger and stronger. One of the great ways of strengthening these capacities and taking the kind of meditation fork of how to carry this further is to go and retreat. And it's a very important part of our particular Buddhist tradition is to go in retreats. We have one-day retreats, weekend retreats, 10-day retreats, 3-month retreats, year-long retreats. The year-long retreats are not organized. You just kind of, you know, figure out how to do it. But to go on longer retreats, and these are usually silent retreats in our tradition, where there's no talking, but you're together with other people usually, and you're cultivating throughout the whole day without particularly any distractions that we usually have in our normal life. We're cultivating the ability for the mind to really stay in the present moment and not wander off. We're cultivating the ability of the mind to be non-reactive. We're cultivating the ability of the mind to get concentrated and really stable and stay in the present moment. And it's really one of the great things to do, I think, in human life, is to be able to go on retreat and be able to cultivate these kinds of capacities without the kind of distractions of having to cook for yourself or having to go to work or having to answer that phone call or answer the mail or pay your bills or, you know, watch Seinfeld or whatever it might be. Just to kind of be undistracted from yourself and doing this kind of in a very continuous way through time. A tremendous intimacy with oneself develops, a kind of intimacy that many people have never experienced for themselves in their life ever, is often cultivated and discovered in the context of doing this kind of practice in the silence of retreat. A level of acceptance of oneself and of the present moment is sometimes unparalleled to other things we often experience in our life. Tremendous insight into how our mind works. I've had people say that a 10-day retreat is equal to 3 years of weekly therapy. It's very, very powerful what can happen on retreats. So these are the two forks that a practitioner might take. They might just kind of begin applying it in their daily life, and they might go off on retreat and kind of cultivate it kind of in a stronger degree on retreat. What I want to talk about mostly today is how to apply it to daily life, how to expand the practice into our daily life. And the first thing, as I said, is have be interested in that, to think that that's valuable to do that. The second is to remember to do it. It's said that mindfulness practice is an incredibly simple practice. It's supposed to be simple. It's designed to be simple. It's basically just noticing what's happening in the present moment as it's happening. Now, is that complicated? You know, we kind of make it complicated by, oh, what if I, you know, if I look underneath here and try to figure this out, and and kind of make it complicated. You know, if I do this, then that'll happen, and you know, or am I doing it right yet? And well, I've gotten so far, but not far enough, and that person's sitting quieter than me, and you know, we kind of make it so complicated. It's really very simple. Just noticing what's happening as it's happening and then trying to make room for that. What's complicated, what's difficult, is remembering to do it. In and of itself, it's easy, but remembering to do it is difficult. So one of the things that's very helpful in daily life and trying to bring it into other areas of our life is to have little reminders through the day to wake up, to pay attention. And you can choose an infinite number of reminders of what you can do. One nice way of doing it is to choose something you do on a regular basis, one thing, and for 1 week, try to cultivate your mindfulness really carefully in that one activity throughout that week. So, for example, maybe you wash the dishes at home. So you're going to really try to develop your mindfulness in washing dishes rather than getting the dishes done. I mean, some of us, when we wash the dishes so to get it done as quickly as we can and get on with our life, to do something else. Just dishes are kind of in our way. We kind of do it because, you know, eventually there's no room in our sink. And so let's do it as quickly as we can, get it over with, so we can get to something more productive and useful in our life. Some of you have that attitude, probably. But to bring mindfulness to washing dishes is to wash your dishes for the dishes for its own sake, just to do it and do it mindfully. It means turning off the radio, not having the portable phone, you kind of like this, and washing the dishes, you know, trying to do other things. But just kind of, what is it like to bring your full attention to bear on just washing dishes? You notice the mind wanders away, just like it does when you're following your breath in meditation. Your mind goes off into planning or thinking or remembering. What is it like to bring the mind back to just washing dishes? To feel what the temperature of the water, to feel the smoothness of the plate or whatever, and just to be there. To notice what it's like to be really present. Notice what happens to inside of you. Sometimes there's a struggle and a fight. I don't want to be present. I hate being present. Because if I'm present, I have to be present to my depression. It's much better to turn on a radio and rush through the dishes, because if I don't rush through the dishes, I'll notice that I'm sad, or whatever you might be feeling. But to cultivate, just very simply, you spend 1 week just doing the dishes. And then the next week, you choose something else, brushing your teeth, or taking a shower, or going to the toilet. The next week, maybe you choose driving to work and driving back from work. Or next week, you might choose turning on and off light switches. Notice what's actually going on when you turn off the light switch. Take a moment. How are you feeling at that particular moment? It's quite remarkable. I used to do this with door frames. Whenever I went through a door frame, the door frame was my reminder to pay attention. So that was kind of where I cultivated it. And it really struck me how I wouldn't know how I was feeling, where I was at with myself, until I walked through a door and took the time to notice. It's remarkable. We can go through hours through a day not noticing how we're feeling or how we're wound up or preoccupied about something. But to me, it's remarkable. Until something stops us and reminds us to pay attention how we're feeling. So door frames. Some people like to do it with at the telephone when it rings. And the telephone becomes a mindfulness bell. So when the telephone rings, we stop. And it's some people are irritated by Buddhists who do this, but you don't have to tell anyone you're doing this. You don't answer the telephone in the first ring. You let it ring 3 or 4 times, and then you just mindfully breathe during those 3 or 4 rings. Or be mindful, just be mindful just generally what's happening right now. And it's remarkable how much it can change the state of your being, state of your mind. Just to take 3 telephone rings. To kind of do nothing but be mindful, nothing but being with your breath. So it's kind of fun. You can kind of choose different areas for a week, and if you do that every week for a year, you've done 52 areas of your life. That's pretty good, and you know, it's kind of like then you get the hang of it in the different areas, and it kind of carries with you, even when you're not intentionally trying to do it anymore. So there's ways of kind of doing it like that. There can be other cues, other suggestions. It can be emotional cues. Whenever you get angry or whenever you get afraid, that's your cue to kind of stop and pay more careful attention to what's going on in the present moment. Whenever you feel your voice getting raising itself, getting stronger, take a moment to stop. One of the things that I found incredibly useful for me in bringing mindfulness into my daily life is to pay a lot of attention to what's going on in my body. And I have a habit of coming back to my body, coming back to my body throughout the day. Because my body will often tell me faster than anything else where I'm at. You know, if I'm sad, I'll be kind of slumped or depressed. Or if I'm anxious, my stomach will be tight. Or different things are going on in my body. And I used to have a habit now. It's become a habit of coming back to my body, coming back to my body. Very, very useful. Some more kind of traditional but practical things to do to help with bringing mindfulness into the rest of our life. It is to have a daily sitting practice. One of the things that strikes me is many times people come to me and say, you know, I want help. Sometimes I'm overwhelmed with feelings and emotions. I come into these really difficult situations in my life. How can I get mindfulness to fix it for me? What's a quick fix? Someone used the word today, quick fix. And I think it's a little bit disrespectful, I think, to want to have quick fixes all the time. Of how we're actually quite complicated beings. And rather, when things to expect mindfulness to work, you know, if you haven't been mindful for, you know, a few weeks, you haven't been doing the daily sitting and just kind of running around your life, suddenly you have a tremendously challenging thing in your life and you expect mindfulness to kind of help you and fix things on the spot is asking for too much. But rather, if you sit every day, have a regular sitting practice, you sit for half an hour, 40 minutes every day, then you're building the tools and building the strength of attention, strength of presence, strength of giving, making room for yourself when things are difficult. So then when you do come into great challenging situations, those tools are there to help. There's this kind of this sense of presence, sense that is there to help. By osmosis, you bring it along. But if you haven't cultivated that foundation, then it might be too much to expect your mindfulness practice to help in great challenging situations. So it's very useful if you want to bring mindfulness in your daily life to have a regular daily sitting practice. It's also extremely useful to sit together with other people, to do meditation together with other people, to have the support of others who are doing the same thing. Makes it easier for us to do it. To have the desire, the intention to sit every day is one thing. But you'll find, many of you find, it's actually kind of difficult sometimes to keep it up because for all kinds of reasons. But to go sit once a week or once every couple of weeks with some other meditation group, you get a sense of other people doing it and encourages each of us to do it more, to kind of continue. Also, we don't feel like we're so unusual. You know, maybe none of your friends meditate and they kind of think you're kind of weird. You know, and so if you come and sit with some other people who are equally weird, you know, you keep yourself company in the weirdness. You know, you don't feel so alone. Or maybe you don't feel like you're so strange or so weird after all. And there's many, you know, we have a sitting group here Thursday nights. We have Monday night sitting group. There are other meditation groups around the area. You might find other ones that are, for some reason, they're more compatible to you than our sitting group. There's a Zen group in Mountain View with the nice teacher, Les Kay. And there's different groups around. There's a sentence from Henry Thoreau's Walden, which has been going through my mind this last week. And I might not have, I probably haven't remembered it too accurately. But I think that maybe in the beginning of Walden, Thoreau says, "I went into the woods to live deliberately." Is that what he says? Is that close enough? "I went into the woods to live deliberately." And I think part of what mindfulness practice the car is quite deliberate. It wants our attention. So we'll just continue. So to live deliberately, deliberately doesn't mean stressfully. It doesn't mean anxiously, but rather to live in a way that with some intention behind our life, some intention to live a life that follows our life's deepest values, our deepest intentions. I think it's very easy for in human life, but I don't know if it's more so in this particular part of the country than anywhere else, but it's very easy to lose touch with our heart's deepest values, to be caught up in ideas of success.
Black VW?
A black VW wants its owner. It's very easy to be caught up with ideas of superficial ideas of success. Money is what will do it, or a particular kind of job, or a particular kind of relationship, or a particular kind of big house, or to lose that. What we want is to have we want to have joy in our life. We want to live a life that really touches other people, or we really want to live a life that allows us to touch ourselves, to really learn how to be present for our own sorrows and our own pains without distracting ourselves from it, to live a life that can listen to the sounds of the birds. or the sounds of a beeping car. And not hold on to one or reject the other. To live a life that doesn't react unskillfully to uncomfortable situations. Here we are. So to live a life, to spend, one of the things that's very useful for the application of the practice in daily life is to spend some time reflecting about what is the deepest priorities and values, the deepest intention you have for yourself in your life. And this is actually a very useful thing to do after you've meditated, not during. But if you spend half an hour, 45 minutes meditating and being kind of quiet and more settled than you usually are, don't kind of get up and immediately rush into your job or rush off and take care of things. Maybe go for a quiet walk or continue sitting and go sit, you know, look out the window with a cup of tea or whatever. And just kind of think about or reflect or feel your way into the question, what are the most important values for me in my life? What do I most want in my life? Is money really what you most want? Or is a big house or a successful job most what you want? Or is there something deeper than that? And if you can find what your deepest values are, then to have the intention to want to live a life based on those values is one of the most useful things you can do in wanting to bring mindfulness into your daily life. So I went into the woods to live deliberately. I went into this world, I go back into my daily life, I go back into work, to live deliberately. Deliberately in the sense of living from my deepest values, what's most important for me. Is it really most important to get the particular job done as quickly as possible so you can move on to something else? Is that actually more important than relating to your coworker as another fellow human being that you can connect to and really have some human contact and warmth with? I know there are people who treat their coworkers as just functionaries. You know, they're kind of we use them for our own purposes to get our own job done as quickly as we can, so we can get the promotion or we can get out of there quickly or so just so we can cope. But is that really how we want to spend 8 hours of our working day? Or 10 or 12 hours, some of us? Kind of not treating the people around us as people we can have warm human relationships to. So to live a life that's deliberate, coming deliberately in a sense from or trying to come from our deepest values. And if mindfulness, if being attention, having attention in what's happening in the present moment, help serve your heart's deepest intention, then it's a lot more easy to be motivated to cultivate a mindfulness practice. And if you can find no connection between your heart's deepest values and cultivating a mindfulness practice, then I recommend one of two things, or maybe both. You might go talk to someone else. If you don't see a connection, maybe talk to other people to find out what kind of connection they've made, or come talk to a teacher. And maybe you can help understanding what the connection is. And if you still can't find any connection, then I recommend you just chuck the mindfulness practice. Just forget it. So do you have any questions or any comments about anything about the instructions or about bringing the practice in your daily life? Yes.
You know, I read a lovely line from St. Ajahn Chah, one of the author, and he was talking about a meditation. After you've meditated and then you go back to your normal life, all you're doing is changing the posture and you're just continuing meditating up there. And that's a lovely way to frame the thing.
Beautiful, exactly. I think when people begin meditating, there's sometimes a sense that you're doing a radically different thing. There's a great boundary between meditation and normal life. But as you start doing meditation more and more, you realize that it's the same mind or the same heart in both situations. and that the division we have between meditation and normal life is an artificial division. And once you realize that, then I think it's quite natural to want to apply to bring the practice into daily life and make it seamless. And so one of the words that Buddhists sometimes use is seamlessness. How to live a life that's seamless. Yes?
I find it really hard not to have an expectation going into meditation. I find that really hard to let go.
Beautiful. So one of the things, when you say something like that, I find it really hard, means it's there in a strong way. Mm-hmm. The practice then is to make expectation your meditation. It's actually turn the mirror of awareness back and really be mindful. I'm sitting here with an expectation. What does it feel like to sit here with an expectation? And make room for that and allow that. And if it's possible, not to be reactive to it, not to judge it. Oh, here's a human being sitting with expectation. Isn't this interesting? What is this like? What happens if I sit with expectation? That's how the practice is done. Because what happens is some people will come to that kind of question and say, well, I'm trying to meditate, but I have all this expectation. I've heard expectation is bad. No, I'm a bad meditator. But the beautiful thing about meditation is mindfulness is there's nothing which is outside the practice. So this is a beautiful example. Is we just gently turn the attention back to the expectation and make room for that. You don't have to believe it, but you bring awareness to it, and then things begin to. The word I wanted to use was unravel, on their own. But if you kind of see the expectation as a problem, then you're in reactive mode to it, or holding it off, or doing something with it. It kind of solidifies it. It makes it a thing. That's a big bad thing, you know. Oh my God, you know. But when we turn mindfulness around to anything and allow it to be there kind of generously, making room for it, it tends not to be some solid and such a terrible thing anymore. And it begins to kind of do its thing. Yes?
You know, Gil, I've been trying to understand a difference in the way that you look at different activities that you might do, and there's actually a hierarchy or a better activity that one can be involved in. For example, I'm the kind of person who, when it comes to dishes or vacuuming the floor, I mean, I just want to, I'm there, but it's not like I want to linger over it, because I prefer to, you know, sit and read a good book or spend more time in the backyard sketching or whatever it is. But is there actually a separation in those activities in terms of the time that you give it, care that you give it, to move on to something that is maybe more fulfilling or pleasurable?
Well, with our common sense, yes. I mean, there's when I was in the monastery in Japan, they had this huge lawn in front of the monastery, and sometimes early in the morning they send all the monks out with these little hand size. You know, and we were very mindful. You know, it's this very mindfully cut lawn. You know, and you know. Maybe it was fine, you know, but and I didn't say anything because. But it seemed like we could have gotten a lawnmower and then just. You know, and mindfully mow the lawn. And then we would have more time to have mindfully taken care of the other things in the temple and needed taken care of. So there is some common sense, you know, that goes into it. And but the point is maybe not to lose our. The only place we can really discover our life and really feel the value and the pleasure of being alive is in the present moment. And what you don't want to do is sacrifice the present moment for efficiency's sake, to get something done so you can get something better. But if you could, but it's fine to make a decision. Well, I'm going to do this a little bit more efficiently, or maybe I'll have someone else do this, or hire someone to do this, so because it takes, you know, I'd rather spend my time doing something else. To some degree, that's a fine decision to make, and how exactly you make that is up to you. I don't know how the rule for how to do it. But you never, what you don't want to do is sacrifice your life in the present moment. So if you, so maybe you try to wash your dishes as quickly and as efficiently as you can. But try to do that so you're there intimately present for it, not sacrificing your life while you do it. And what's beautiful, I think, is it's possible to discover or find a way to feel a kind of warm presence in pretty much whatever we do. And what we value is the warm how we do things, not the what we do, becomes more important. This spiritual life has a lot to do with how we do things, not what we do. So we begin valuing the how more than the what. And but you can still, within that, you can still decide for sure. I mean, you're supposed to decide within that. You know, it's fine to choose one thing over the other to some degree. In the back.
I just realized as you were talking that in the space of this last year, I guess year and a half, I've been sitting here in one of my meditation classes. I left a pre-IPO startup and I work for a nonprofit now, where I value a lot more the fact that I can take the time to develop the relationships like you were talking about earlier, and where I don't end up treating people like they're just these entities I work with and I leave that world behind. When I do my hour commute home, I don't have any of that anymore, and my life is a lot more seamless. And I found, what I think I found is that in finding where more of my values are, the things that are good for me and that help me and heal, I can apply it to both my personal life and my work life, and the two all of a sudden meld more together more easily.
Thank you very much. It's inspiring to hear that. Yes?
When you were talking about that woman's expectations in meditation, could you talk a little bit about what happens if you're in the midst of meditation and you're in pain? How you treat that as like a friend or not as something that you want to get rid of?
You bring your attention to it.
Okay. And you're still in pain.
You're still in pain? Well, you bring your attention to it and you explore it. You just kind of bring your attention carefully, make room for it, explore and kind of try to bring your attention as carefully as you can to really get to know it well. Pain is usually different, is very different close up than it is, you know, from a distance. So you're going to get really close and kind of concentrate on it. And just kind of maybe breathe with it if you want. And one of the things we study is the relationship we have to it. So I hate it, or we have self-pity, or we have tremendous aversion or whatever. We can often form a relationship to it, and that relationship is different than the pain. And if you can see that the relationship is different than the pain, then there's a little bit more space to allow the pain to be there without making it such a big deal. And it's possible to have tremendous pain. You can be dripping with sweat and pain. And at the same time, the mind is equanimous. The mind is completely at peace with it. It's actually very useful and very important to cultivate mindfulness practice with any kind of discomfort or pain or distress that might arise, because part of what the practice is developing ability to be non-reactive. And you're really put to the test then. And you really get to see very clearly how your mind relates to things and what's going on. So part of the practice when there's physical pain is just bring careful attention to it. And sometimes it makes things a lot easier, because when we're reactive to pain, there's sometimes a tendency to tighten down around it, to get tense in various places in the body, but it can actually make it worse. But to bring non-reactive awareness to the pain can sometimes actually soften around it and make it easier. So, something like that. I don't know if it's used to, it's, I think, is there in the tape library, is there my talk on pain there? Or Barbara has it. I gave a talk once that was taped on pain. The whole talk, I should do that again. Does this respond to you, or you look kind of like you're grimacing, oh my God.
I'm just probably getting caught up in aversion and fear that it's going to get more painful and all that.
Exactly. and to see that really clearly is very powerful. And one of the opportunities in meditation is to see it so clearly in meditation, become such an expert in seeing it in meditation, that we begin noticing it sooner and better in our normal life before we acting out on it. It's often good to see what happens in meditation as being a microcosm of how you respond to things in your normal life. So it's very useful. Whatever you learn in meditation almost directly applies to normal, the rest of your life. Yes?
Now that I've been meditating for a while, I'm beginning to notice that the certain things that are really in my way, they seem very highlighted somehow to me. And one of the ones I wanted to ask about is restlessness. Now, it used to be that I used to keep myself so scheduled up. I mean, just you know, I had something doing every minute. So I don't want to do that so much anymore, except I noticed I had a real burst of it last weekend. It was, like, really bad. Is that restlessness?
Could be. I'm not sure what to say except that it's very what we do in the mindfulness practice is when there's strong restlessness, is we sit there, we bring just mindfulness to restlessness. You know, and you can, it's actually very interesting to sit. It's very useful in meditation to sit very still when there's a lot of restlessness, to really be dedicated to sitting still. And if you do nothing else, and just sit still, and not even be very mindful, but you're successfully sitting still, that's very powerful with restlessness. And you can sit there and you kind of vow, I'm going to be the first meditator to die of restlessness. Because no one has yet. And just to open to it and allow the restlessness to kind of course throughout your body. And it's probably what the restlessness most wants. It wants to have space and room just to kind of be there without it necessarily being acted on. Just kind of have this freedom to move inside your body. It's very uncomfortable, but it's very, very useful to do that. As we get to know restlessness, and so as we allow restlessness to be there, we get to know it better. And as we get to know it better, sometimes it gets revealed that restlessness is there because there's something very uncomfortable that we don't want to face. Some deep grief or sadness or conflict or whatever, and you just want to get away from it. Restlessness is a strategy to get away from something, you know, anything, you know, any direction at all, but here. So if that reveals itself, then it can be a little bit easier then to come and really be with the discomfort, or to choose some other wise way to be with it. Yes, Renata.
Today I had a really hard time kind of sitting, being there, and I got off into thoughts, and then I fell over and almost went to sleep, and then I really just wanted to open my eyes and stop doing this, and I realized that I was impatient, and I said, impatient, you know, and and that was when I really got present. It was the first time that I didn't get up. I think it was the first time that I didn't get caught up in impatience, you know, like acting on it, but kind of like just experiencing it.
Beautiful. Beautiful. That's powerful. So when you finally could recognize what was going on, it had less control over you.
Yeah.
So it was a testimonial for how powerful it is to notice what's going on. It's true. Thank you. Maria.
One of the things that interests me is the relationship between time and mindfulness. Because I think we kind of come into it thinking that mindfulness is going to take up time, absorb time. So, like paying attention to the dishes. But mindfulness doesn't mean slow.
Right.
It only means aware.
Right.
And what's interesting to me is that my experience is when I'm mindful that there's more life and not less.
Right.
I think we've all had the experience of going through a span of time and saying, where did the time go? Because we simply aren't paying any attention to it. So every piece of mindfulness gives us more life.
Absolutely.
And I think that's one of the most delightful things about it. And I really had this fear that if I started paying attention to everything, I wouldn't be able to get my work done, and I wouldn't be able to... But that's not true at all. I mean, it's the opposite is really true.
So let's end with a short sitting. Oh, yes. So closing your eyes. And then remembering that mindfulness is not about attaining or getting to some wonderful state necessarily. Mindfulness is as simple as noticing how you are right now. And allowing yourself to be as you are right now. In a sense, making room for that. A silent room. And when there's a tendency to get lost in thought, then you can use the breath as a way of stabilizing yourself in the present moment. Breath is always in the present. So this is the end of the 5-week introductory course. I hope it's been useful for you, and you can take some of this with you back into your normal life. Next week we revert back to our normal Thursday schedule. Thursdays is a little bit more for newer students. Usually the topics for discussion on Thursdays tend to be more narrowly focus on the practice itself, whereas Monday nights when we have our meetings, the topics can range quite a bit. And we sit at 7 for half an hour, and then we have 45 minutes of discussion, and then we end with 15 minutes of sitting. And in the weeks after, in the 5-week introductory course, the topics that usually follow are kind of like a continuation of the introductory course, like the 6th week, the 7th week. So you might want to continue coming if you'd like. During the summer months, I'm not here every Thursday, but just kind of when I'm not here, some other speaker will be here. And as always, the way we teach is always on donation basis. So if you'd like to make donations, there's two baskets out in the hall. I brought with me today this book that I helped edit that some of you might be interested in. It's kind of an introductory book to this practice. I wrote an introduction where I kind of give the basic instructions for mindfulness and also the basic instruction for another kind of meditation that we do called loving-kindness meditation. And then it's a talk by each of the 12 or so mindfulness teachers who teach through Spirit Rock, this meditation center we're building in Marin County. And it's a nice way to kind of introduction to the basic practice. It's a nice way to be introduced to the different teachers. I have a talk in here on fear. And also, the book was, it's kind of very nice, this book, I think, because it was entirely a labor of love. It's entirely a labor of all volunteer work. No one made any money from it, just everybody volunteered, including the publishing of it. It was all volunteer and printing of it. And all the money from the sales of it go to building the meditation hall. We're building at Spirit Rock. So it's a wonderful... So you're buying this as really a donation rather than just, you know, a profit in a sense. So you, there's some copies out there if you want. Also, Allison here, she sells inexpensively meditation paraphernalia. So like these cushions people sit on, the round cushions or the half moon cushions or these benches, wooden benches. And if any of you are interested in getting it somewhat inexpensively, you can talk to Allison afterwards. So thank you all for participating in the 5-week course, and I wish you all well.